Welcome to The Natural Selection, where this week's theme is Sub-Zero. Welcome, listeners, to The Natural Selection, a group of taxonomists who try and bring their passion for nature into the wild. So we were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we are Nick.
Hello.
We are Naomi.
Hello.
And I am Nick. Hello. So have you two had a nice week?
Well, Nick, I have to do a little behind-the-scenes reveal, I think, this week. Since we last recorded, because of the scheduling of this week, I've been outside for a total of 10 minutes.
How were those 10 minutes?
I thought I heard what could have been a fox, but I didn't see it because it was dark.
Yeah, but you live in Neukölln, so that could have been anything.
It could have been anything.
Yeah. It was meant to snow tonight, but then I saw they changed the weather forecast, so I'm saying.
Yeah, alas. But it could still happen sometime this week. It's supposed to be pretty cold.
Yeah, it is. I went out earlier. It's certainly cold.
I wouldn't know, but... No, for the 10 minutes I was outside, I was very cold. So, yes. Yeah.
You agree with that. How's old Blighty?
Yeah, similarly, have not been outside a huge amount. It is also cold. It's nice, though. It's that kind of nice cold where the sky is blue and the sun is shining, but it's cold. So I appreciate that. As opposed to the cold that I'm used to at home where it rains on you and then you freeze because you're damp and cold. So, but I got that to look forward to in a couple of weeks.
Oh, Nick, what about you?
Oh, yeah, fine. I tore a pair of trousers, so most of my outside adventuring is to find new trousers.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I was in a very suave way. I was climbing onto my bicycle and my shoelace got caught on the back wheel thingy. And then I fell over, entangled in my own bicycle and ripped what I suppose would be called the gusset of my jeans.
Except for the final horrible moment, Nick, the same thing happened to me the other day. I got caught in my bike and I fell over.
I'm so glad it's not just me.
No. It was just us.
Yeah. But luckily, because of the internet, we are not entirely cut off from the outside world. So we were able to look up some amazing nature news from around the world, from people who maybe were a bit more proactive in going outside, people who are less likely to rip their trousers open while climbing on a bicycle. So yeah, should we come back after this short break with the news?
Definitely.
And Nick, I believe you found something pretty cool.
Yeah. And not only is it coming from around the world, it's coming from South Africa in a different season 3 years ago. But the research has just been published now, so I guess we're going to consider it news. This was basically the discovery of a new type of plant-animal interaction. Not new to science or new to the world, but new in a certain way. So let me get into it a little bit. Guthria capensis is the Latin name of the hidden flower, as it's locally known, which is an enigmatic flower known from some mountaintops in South Africa. And it grows really close to the ground, and it's got a quite a big flower petal bowl, but it's not very showy, and it's often hidden beneath leaves, which is sort of often a sign for researchers studying plant dynamics that says, oh, this plant is not pollinated by flying insects, because usually the flying insects have flowers that are ostentatious and showy and bright and colorful and out in the open, up in the air, so they can land on them and pollinate them flower to flower. Usually this is a sign for researchers that the flower is pollinated by small mammals, as a matter of fact. So a pair of researchers, a husband and wife pair, were on a little vacation for fun, and they noticed this flower and they thought, actually, we'd like to stay and study this for a while. So they roped in a couple of local researchers, and all four of them spent a few weeks camping out on this mountainside. And they were trying to figure out what pollinated this flower because there wasn't any local studies. And they thought maybe it's some interesting local rodent or something that is doing this. But what ended up happening, they set a few camera traps and waited. And a few days went by, and nothing set off the camera traps. And they were setting them at night, because mostly these mammals that eat nectar are nocturnal. And they thought, well, nothing's happening, so let's do it in the day, too. And still nothing. And yet, the flowers were still, it seemed, being pollinated. Some fruits were developing. And eventually they thought, okay, well, we'll expand the sensitivity of the camera traps, because these are infrared cameras. They're sensitive to the animal's basically body temperature, the heat as they step into the range frame. And when they increased the sensitivity, they finally caught their culprit. And the reason it wasn't setting off the camera traps before is because it wasn't endothermic, which we'll get to a bit in later in our episode. But it wasn't producing its own heat because it was a lizard. So this isn't the first time that lizard-pollinated flowers have been described. It's one of the first in Africa, one of only a couple of dozen different types of species that have specific interactions between the flower and the lizard. I think it's a pretty cool study, and I especially like the sort of story of doing the research behind it. So that's why I brought this one to you guys today.
It's a great excuse to stay on holiday, isn't it?
A working holiday, if you will.
Yeah, if only we could do that, if we went to sort of somewhere really sunny and we're like, oh, do you know what? I saw a really nice flower, so I'm gonna stick around for a bit.
There's nothing stopping us except everything.
I never think about reptiles as pollinators, so that's really cool that they were able to find this interaction.
Oh, I should say the name of the lizard is Pseudocordylus subviridis. It's bright green. And it's also known as the Drakensberg Crag Lizard, or in English, the Dragon Mountain Crag Lizard.
Nice.
What a great name.
It looks super cute.
Nick, I can rival you for news that is not news.
You mean it's old news?
Oh, it's so old. In April 10th, 2015, the NOAA, or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration from America, was sending down one of their submersibles, which is an unmanned submersible, deep into the ocean, about nearly 4 kilometers down, just off the coast of Puerto Rico. They were looking with this high-definition camera attached to the submersible. And for the first time ever, they've only just certified a new species of undersea creature based solely on high-definition video footage from the bottom of the ocean. So this new species, which now exists, is Duobrachium sparxae. It's not only just a new species, it's actually an entirely new genus. It's a ctenophore, but I never know how much to say the C. So I just pretend to say it, but as I ignore the C at the beginning, just know that I'm thinking about it. It's a ctenophore, which are often called cone jellies. They look like jellyfish to us. But what distinguishes them is they have these combs on their side, which they use to swim. They sort of undulate, I guess would be the right word, but they're sort of a wave that goes up and down them, and that's how they swim. And because of the structure of them, they act like a prism. So as they do this, they sort of like glitter with different lights. They're absolutely beautiful, the ctenophores. And it's a pretty big one. So this one is about 6 centimeters long in its body, and it has 2 tentacles, one on either side, which run for about 30 to 55 centimeters behind it. And they're actually able to observe some behavior in one of the individuals they observed. It was actually using these tentacles to latch on to the ocean floor. So that was really interesting to see. This is such an odd design and behavior. They were able just to use this HD footage to diagnose it as a completely new genus and species.
So does that mean that the type specimen will be a photograph? Or is it not gotten that far yet for classification?
I suppose it would be the video, wouldn't it? I don't know whether it would be a photograph or the video in that situation. That's a really good question.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I feel like it has a lot of implications for conservation and how type species are defined, because that can get kind of a tricky subject. A lot of times you need an actual specimen. So it'd be really interesting if this is the case where they're able to use this.
Mm. Now, Naomi, again, you seem to have picked the coolest news.
Yeah, I got lucky this week. I found something really interesting, I think. So the piece of research that I found was published in Nature Communications at the end of November 2020. So this work was looking at what they found is that there's a mineral armor on leaf cutting ants. So this is quite interesting for several reasons. So this was actually discovered by accident. They were looking at how microbes interact with these ants, and they found that there was some sort of coating on them. They couldn't get it off because they wanted to try and look at this interaction, so they needed to get rid of it. They couldn't get it off. So eventually they decided to use mouthwash to remove it. Then they realized that it was a mineral coating. And this is the first time that they found a mineral coating, so it's calcite, on an insect. Now, some of you might be thinking that actually this isn't uncommon for arthropods because a lot of crustaceans would have this calcite armor, but insects don't. They've also found that it makes their exoskeleton twice as hard, and it means that they can also seem to be able to survive attacks from larger soldier ants. So in this work, they did some kind of manipulation experiments where they put in other species of soldier ants, and they put in different ants with the armor and then without the armor, and they found they were better at surviving if they had this armor in place. Another great implication of this piece of work is that it means that maybe it's been overlooked in other things, because leafcutter ants are quite a well-studied species, and this is the first time this has been discovered. So perhaps it's in other things. They're not sure how it's produced, this calcite mineral armor. Perhaps it's microbes. They're not 100% sure yet, but I think more research will be done on this.
I love that. That we can spend so long studying these creatures and then, yeah, only just find out that they're like heavily armored.
Yeah, so the species is Acromyrmex echinacior, and so it's a species of leafcutter ant. But there's lots of different species of leafcutter ant, but this particular one, the worker ants seem to have this calcite layer over their exoskeleton.
It reminds me of the news that came out a couple weeks ago about the platypus fur being fluorescent under UV light, something that no one who studied platypus knew until someone, they accidentally shone a UV light on some specimens. Like you said, Nick, these things that we find out about, things that we think we know a lot about, suddenly sort of reveal how much we don't know.
All they would have had to have done is taken a platypus to a rave.
I mean, you could say take a platypus to a rave, but observe a platypus at a rave is another option.
Well, what was actually paradoxically a really good anti-climax. We will end the news, but you guys ready to cool things down a little bit?
Let's put the news on ice.
Yeah, we don't want our theme to be too negative, but we're about to go sub-zero, so we'll be back after this short break. So listeners, we are back and we are here to talk about the pressing issue in all of our lives, well, at least those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. It's pretty cold, and we've adapted to that by drinking more tea and wearing thicker socks. But animals, they can't just wear thicker socks. They have to deal with some other problems. Isn't that right, Nose?
Yeah, so actually, I wanted to start off with something that isn't a problem. I wanted to talk about something that is really beneficial to us and that is sort of an anomaly that has worked out very well. So I wanted to talk about water and ice. So this might be something that you guys already know, but I think perhaps I fell asleep when I was taught this in chemistry. So I want to talk about some of the things, the properties that water has that make it really beneficial to us and useful. So liquids generally expand as they heat up, but water does not. There's a little bit of an anomaly in water, and that between 0 and 4 degrees. So 0 is when it freezes, and 100 degrees Celsius is when it boils, turns into steam. But between 0 and 4 degrees Celsius, water actually contracts instead of expanding, like other liquids might. And then after that, it starts expanding again. So this means that ice floats. Other liquids, this wouldn't be the case. If it behaved in the way that other liquids did, the ice would sink to the bottom. Now, this would mean that in seas or lakes or rivers, that instead of the ice floating to the top and having lots of water underneath, the water would start freezing from the bottom up instead of the top down. And this would make not a very habitable environment, particularly considering that water may have been where life started off. This is really important for us that there's this available niche.
Naomi, I was going to say, I think I speak for all of life on Earth when there's nothing worse than a cold bottle.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, that I just wanted to say that little caveat that water is something, and freezing water is something that has been really beneficial to us. So if you think about a frozen lake or a frozen pond, there's life still underneath that. The oxygen gets trapped underneath the ice and things are able to live.
I was actually looking at water of a slightly different type, because while lakes and ponds freeze at a measly 0, seawater, which is packed full of salts, can actually go a little bit colder. And this means that some animals have to live in water which is below 0 degrees, or even swim around in it. So seawater, when it is just below zero, it doesn't freeze yet because the salt's in it from it freezing, will actually sink. So the water will get very, very cold at the bottom of the ocean and then head towards zero at the top with ice at the very top, which is even colder. It means that animals have to cope with sub-zero water. And there's quite a famous adaptation to that. And I'm sure you guys have heard of it. It's Blubber.
I love Blubber.
Yeah.
Is that Robin Williams' movie?
No, you're thinking of Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, shoot.
Blubber is something we've all heard of. And I'm sure you guys know that blubber is just the layer of fat, right? So why don't we have blubber? And it's not just because, you know, we've been watching Our Weight Before Christmas and I didn't have that second pizza. Yeah, why isn't what we have called blubber? Do you guys know?
I don't know, but my first intuitive guess is that it's not dense enough.
Well, actually, it's not the density that really is the key defining issue of it. So there are many animals on land which have it, but blubber is only ever used to describe animals which live in the ocean. And the main groups which we describe blubber, having blubber, are penguins, whales, dolphins, seals, and sea cows or dugong. What the big difference is between blubber in those animals and adipose tissue in animals on land is the vasculature. So blubber is really well supplied with blood vessels. And this is what distinguishes it from just a layer of fat on the outside, is this level of vasculature. And sometimes it's very, very thick. Things like right whales, I think it can be nearly a foot thick. Some animals, 50% of their body mass is blubber. But it's kind of interesting because they would have this as an adaptation to sea, because there's cold places on Earth. In fact, some animals have to deal with much colder temperatures than, say, many whales. So why don't they have blubber? And you look at things like bison in the Great Plains, where there's very cold winds coming in, say, Canada and things like that, are absolutely freezing, that they have to deal with them, but they cope with fur instead. Whereas you can't use that underwater, because how fur actually works is it traps a layer of air, which can then become warm. But the problem is when you go underwater, this layer of air disappears. But what you'll notice is that animals that live on both land and sea will retain either fur or feathers. So penguins have feathers as well as blubber. Seals have fur, quite thick fur, as well as blubber, because they will spend a lot of time on land. Whereas whales, dolphins, and sea cows have all completely lost their hair and rely entirely on blubber. And it actually has some really cool properties which make it really useful. So one of them is it makes the animal super streamlined. Because it's such a thick, basically wobbly, jelly-like layer, it can create quite a smooth shape while still encasing all of the animal's organs. So you get that classic sort of swimming shape from whales or dolphins. It can also have a really positive effect on buoyancy. So if they don't want to waste energy swimming up to the surface, it can actually make them quite buoyant. The problem is when they do dive deep, like I said, the water gets colder as they dive, and many whales dive deeply to feed. And that's where the vasculature can become really useful, because they can actually completely shut off all of the blood supply to their blubber, so they don't lose any heat as they dive. So it acts even better as an insulator. It also isn't necessarily dependent on the thickness, but the level of lipid content or water content is actually a better signifier of how much of an insulator it is and how cold the environment the animal lives in is. And interestingly from that is the buoyancy can be a big problem with animals that feed on the bottom of the sea, which is sea cows. So relatively, they actually have less blubber than the other animals, because otherwise it would constantly bring them up to the surface, and they don't want to do that. They want to stay on the seafloor eating grass. So yeah, that's blubber.
Cool. That was very cool, Nick. Very clear.
But some of those animals I all mentioned have something in common, is that they can generate their own heat.
Nick, yes, that's right. All of those animals that you mentioned are endotherms, meaning they produce heat inside. Sort of roughly modern groups that are endotherms are mammals and birds. But that's not the only kind of animals that are out there. So a classic example of the opposite of an endotherm, an ectotherm, things that need outside temperatures to control their inside temperatures, are reptiles. If you think about a lizard or snake basking in the sun, they're getting warm so that they can do their metabolic things and go about their days and hiss at people and eat things and pollinate flowers. And this sort of ectotherm, endotherm is, I think, maybe the most basic of the metabolic rate differences that we encounter when we're studying in school. But there's a ton more, maybe not outside the ectotherm, endotherm spectrum, but in different sort of dimensions, if you will, of metabolic rate and engagement with the environment and the internal biology. So I want to talk about a couple of these, but let's first start with one that can kind of make intuitive sense, the mesotherm. So this is in the middle. of ectotherm and endotherm. And they're usually things that they aren't producing their own heat, but they stay sort of, they have qualities of both. So a great example of this is a tuna, which has a really thick sort of red muscle in it that most fish don't have. And that helps them basically generate metabolic heat just from the muscle moving around that keeps their bodies warm, even the cold, cold seas that they live in. So tunas have a pretty high, stable body temperature, even though they're not, they don't have the same adaptations that birds and mammals do have for endotherm. Another good example are the sea turtles and some bees, even. Interestingly, there are even a couple of mammals that have this sort of opposite direction into mesothermy. So they need the temperature around them to stay relatively constant. And that includes our favorites, the naked mole rats, which makes sense. They don't have any insulating fur, but that's not necessarily an indicator because humans are considered endotherms too, and we don't have insulating fur unless you haven't shaved for a while. So one of the other things that I sort of want to bring to our attention is the difference between homeothermy and heterothermy. And these, if we use our knowledge of Latin roots, we can get a pretty good sense of what these are. Homeothermy is when the inside stays the same. So the temperature of the body is pretty much constant. And heterothermy, on the other hand, has a range of body temperatures on the inside. And it's related to something called poikilothermy, which is this sort of wide range or extreme range of temperatures on the inside of the body. So a good example of this, to clarify with two different animals, mice are homeothermic. They maintain their body temperature at a really stable temperature, no matter what the temperature is outside, and they can produce a high amount of output, metabolic, energetic production within that body temperature range. But if their core body temperature goes outside of that range, they can't do much at all. They'll overheat or they'll freeze. And that's true for us as well. But things like frogs, for example, are super heterothermic. Their core temperature can range over a huge amount, probably something like 20 degrees Celsius around, but their overall output at its peak, metabolic output or energetic output, is not nearly as high as the mouse's, but it's able to continue producing energy and metabolic output across the wide range of core body temperature. So in the end, if you look at sort of the area under the graph of the metabolic output curve in different temperatures, they produce about the same overall, but the peak in the mouse is much higher and the range is much narrower. One final example before I wrap up here. There are some animals that do something called regional heterothermy. This is where most of the body is homeothermic, and then a part of the body they allow to have this wide range and they can sustain it. So I'll talk a bit later in a different theme about frostbite in humans and what that actually does, but it's when our limbs get too cold and our cells burst. In penguins, their feet are exposed. They don't have insulating fur or feathers. So you might think they're walking on that ice all winter long with their exposed skin on that cold, cold ice. Why aren't their feet freezing? Or you might think, why don't their feet stick to the ice? And the answer to that, you might have guessed, is regional heterothermy. They basically have a really closely packed network of veins and arteries taking blood to and away from the feet that pass over each other in their legs and feet. And this allows a temperature gradient. So when the blood comes back from the cold feet towards the heart, it warms up by the blood coming down from the heart. And then that blood cools as it enters the feet. And it basically means that their feet temperature is always very, very much colder than the rest of their body. But because they have this heterothermy adaptation, their feet, they don't freeze and cells don't rupture, and they can live the whole winter long incubating their little eggs and swimming in the ocean and without losing their feet. So.
Snig, you are a resident literary correspondent. Have you read the book, Why Don't Penguins Feet Freeze?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Ah, I've never felt so smug. Have you, Naomi?
I haven't.
It's from New Scientist. They have a question section at the back where they answer odd questions, a bit harsh, but they're usually questions from children, which are very pertinent scientific questions. And one of them was, why don't penguins' feet freeze? And they contact an expert in the field and they will answer them. But it's a wonderful book, if anyone gets a chance to read it. I think I've got a copy. I'll lend you it, Nick.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, I'd love to read it.
So interesting that you brought up penguins there, Nick, because that was one of the first things I thought about when we discussed this topic of sub-zero and cold temperatures, I thought penguins, classic example of an animal that lives in a really cold environment. But something interesting that I found, a new piece of research that came out pretty recently this year in PNAS, found that it was looking at genomes, and they were looking at penguin diversification and how they diversified and the evolution of penguins. But they found that actually the crown group of penguins probably evolved in Australia or New Zealand. And then the sister group, which would be the Aptenodites, which would be the emperor penguins and king penguins, is sister group to all the other groups of penguins. So these penguins probably evolved in temperate regions and then actually evolved into colder climates, which isn't really something we think of. I personally think of penguins as being a very classic cold adapted animal. So the cold, though, did actually probably help them in their diversification. Probably these currents probably helped spread them around and allow them to get to different places because they are quite widespread. There's, depending on who you ask, there's about 20 species of penguin. So this is something that Nick brought up a couple of episodes ago, the new species of penguin, but other people split certain species and other people lump them together. So I'll say about 20, but other people will say less or more.
It's quite a surprise that taxonomists can't seem to agree.
Yes, yeah, it's shocking, really. But yeah, I thought this was really interesting. Something I didn't think about. So they would have evolved maybe in the Miocene. And also something else about their evolution, they probably would have evolved from birds that were flighted. So they think that the way that they would have evolved to be flightless, it was kind of a trade-off between diving and flight. So in order to get better at diving and be able to dive further, their flippers would have evolved for that, and that meant that they wouldn't have been able to fly anymore. They've kind of been able to test this in other birds, say the guillemot. They're quite good at diving, not quite as good as the penguin, but they tend to find it harder to fly. It takes them a little bit more energy to fly. So the adaptations that they've put into diving have disadvantaged them in flight. So this is why they think that penguin lost flight.
Oh, that's interesting. As it became easier to swim, it would have become harder to fly.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think because they sort of had developed into this niche where there was quite a lot of food available for them when they were diving, that it was more beneficial for them to continue doing this instead of trying to fly.
So that by that logic, like Michael Phelps would be terrible at flying.
So yeah, this is, so even though they maybe didn't first evolve to this cold was influential in their evolution of, and this paper thinks that as they moved to different colder regions, this helped them diversify into different groups.
Everything we've spoken about so far tends to involve a level of movement to protect yourself. But I was thinking about things that can't protect themselves and sort of have to stand there and take the cold, which is trees. So they do some amazing things, some things that really blew my mind, because I don't know a lot about trees. I'm always fascinated to learn more about trees because they do some absolutely incredible things. So as most of you know, that we have deciduous trees that live in areas which go below zero. And part of the problem with when you're stuck in an area that's below zero is if the water inside your cells freeze, it will cause ice crystals, which will puncture the cell and kill the cell. And if it kills enough of your cells, you'll die. And for a tree, standing there in the middle of winter in, say, northern Norway, it's good to get cold. So how do they deal with this? And there's three main ways they cope with this. And one of them is sort of fortuitous in a way, because it's not really... evolve that way, but it's how life works, is that if they suddenly freeze, like there's a very, very sudden drop in temperature, then this can cause big, big problems. But if they gradually freeze, if the temperature gets slowly lower, then they're actually okay up to a point. Because what this causes is something called extracellular freezing, where the water between the cells actually freezes, but not the water inside. And when this happens, what this weirdly does is it actually draws water from outside of the cell. So when this happens, the biggest danger is things like dehydration. Because, yeah, all the cells start to lose their water. And if they lose enough, that the cell walls in the middle actually touch. And if they touch, they react with each other. And again, that kills the cell. So they have to watch out for dehydration in that situation. But one way they cope with this is if they live in an area where they know there's going to be repeated freezing and they need to deal with it, say Canada, some trees can cope by dealing with super freezing. Have you ever seen those videos online where there's a bottle of water and then someone flicks it and then it suddenly starts to freeze?
I was in school before COVID. I saw that in real life.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't see that at school.
Oh my gosh. It's super easy to do. You can do it at home.
Oh, I feel like I might have been betrayed by my education here. But they can super cool the water inside their cells. And they do this by pumping sugars into their cells. And this creates a solution which is much, much harder to freeze. You guys might recognize that. Any guesses what we call that?
Maple syrup?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sap, I guess, technical term.
definitely thought that the answer there was going to be antifreeze.
No, it's maple syrup. Maple syrup. Something slightly more delicious to drink and makes you less blind.
You did help me with Canada. I was like, yeah, really tipped me off.
So it is sap. That's what we call it. And it's a tree's reaction to living in a very cold environment. And in Canada, the maple trees, specifically the sugar maple and the black maple, the most common ones to use for, will create a syrup or a sap that we use to make maple syrup. So it doesn't come out as maple syrup. You have to boil it off first. It comes out looking a bit like water. But interesting, the maple trees, those maple trees, they grow all the way down to Tennessee. And if there's anything you know about Tennessee, it's in the south, it's pretty hot. It doesn't really get as cold as Canada. And the trees down there don't produce maple syrup because they don't need to, because it's a reaction to living in a cold environment. So they have to live in an area where they're going to be sub-zero because that's what they're adapted for. And that's when they create the maple syrup. Now, the third one is weird. So the third one is vitrification. Now, Nick, you know a little bit about Greek and Latin. And I don't even know which one this is, but do you know what vitrification might mean?
It sounds to me like it means turning into glass.
You are exactly right.
But I don't understand how that would work in a plant.
So what they do, I don't fully understand this, having read about it, but they make the inside of their cells glass because the environment gets so cold that they don't want it to freeze and they don't want the cell walls to touch. So they turn the inside of their cells into glass using certain proteins. And these trees can do amazing things. So one, the Japanese white birch, this is something that can go through vitrification, has been shown to survive after being exposed to liquid helium, which is about minus 260 degrees centigrade. So this vitrification offers a huge level of protection against the cold.
Wow.
But yeah, it does mean for a short time in the winter that tree is made of glass.
I've never heard of that before.
No, I hadn't either. I was absolutely staggered when I heard that. And I still can't quite understand how a tree could do that and live.
Nick, I don't understand how that works, but it seems like it would really, like you said at the beginning of this, only work for things that don't move. I think you, even in an animal, if you turned yourself to glass, bad things would happen. But there are some animals that do crazy things like the trees that I want to talk about. And they go under the category of maybe we could think of them as like bio antifreeze, like natural antifreeze. So one of the most well-studied of these is the wood frog, which goes into a period of hibernation when it gets cold. And it doesn't, some frogs that we know, they dig into burrows and underground. It gets cold, but not freezing, and they can sort of hibernate through the winter down there. But the wood frog actually freezes, just in the same way you're describing the trees do, Nick. And they can go through any number of freeze-thaw cycles throughout the winter because of the way that they freeze. Basically, they cover themselves up with leaves near the surface, and the ice, as the sort of woods around them and then the air around them and then their skin starts to freeze, the ice crystals cover the skin first and the frog becomes like a crunchy, not that you would want to crunch it, but like a tough frozen shell. One of the researchers working on this in the article that I was reading described it as when you drop it, it goes clink.
Nick, I said this before and I'll say it again. Science, stop doing weird stuff to frogs.
I agree with you, Nick. It needs to be said as many times as it's done. So basically, a type of protein will cause the water in the blood of these frogs to freeze first. And after the water is frozen, That ice sucks the water out of the frog's cells, just like you were describing in the trees. It dehydrates them. But at the same time, rather than sap, the frog's liver starts to make a lot of glucose, which we have in our bodies. It's very common in animals, which is basically a different type of sugar, and it packs it into the cell. It's sort of like a syrup that keeps the cell structure maintained while the water gets sucked out of it. So essentially, the whole frog is like a syrupy soup with the water frozen in the blood. In our skin, when we freeze, when we get frostbite, the ice crystals suck the water out of our cells and our cells collapse, which is why our skin gets damaged when we get frozen, and eventually, if it stays cold for long enough, you can lose limbs. But frogs aren't the only animals that have this sort of antifreeze ability, but there's a more interesting kind, I think, or at least less familiar than glucose. Have you heard of snow fleas? It doesn't sound super nice, but they're a type of what's called, they're a springtail, a type of springtail, which is not an insect, but a member of the Columbella, which is a modern hexapod related to the insects in the Arthropoda, but they're not actually in the insect group, but they look really similar. They're sort of like six-legged. They walk around on snow. And they're this dark blue creature. They're pretty small, about less than a centimeter, and they jump around, and that's why they get the name snow fleas. But they're always active in this winter time. They're some of the only things you can see out active during the dead of winter. And the way that they do it is not with glucose protein, but with glycine protein, which is apparently, according to the researchers studying the chemistry of their cells, it's unlike any previously known protein, this glycine-rich sort of mix that they use as their antifreeze within their cells. So rather than freeze their cells, they fill them with something that isn't water so that they don't have to worry about those ice crystals. And even when they're filled with that sort of glycine-rich protein, they can still move around and do all the things that they normally would need to do, like eat and mate and sing. And I don't know what else. Oh, and jump. That's what some fleas do. They jump and ride little toboggans down the snow slopes. So one brief side note to all of this talk about bio-antifreeze is a little bit of a connection back to us. No, but researchers are looking at ways of using both the stuff that we find in the frog protein and this glycine-rich protein in the snow fleas in organ transplants to keep organs from deteriorating in between their sort of donor and the person receiving the organ. And usually what would happen is you'd want to keep them on ice, but if you keep them on ice for too long, maybe more than a few hours, then this cell destruction happens with the ice crystals poking through and the cells collapsing and all this horrible stuff. So they don't keep very long on ice. They have to sort of go directly from person to recipient. So if you could figure out a way of freezing organs without the cells rupturing, that would be great. Another way that they're looking at using these, especially this glycine-type protein, the snow flea protein, is in ice cream. Because the way the ice cream forms, it requires tiny, tiny, tiny ice crystals that won't melt and refreeze into big ones, which is what gives ice cream that has gotten melted and then refrozen, that like flaky, crunchy, nasty texture that you get when you've been too long on the way home from the store. The last thing I want to talk about in this theme is something that doesn't use antifreeze. We've heard about the tardigrades, our little water bears, and they do amazing things. We have heard about them surviving boiling waters, acid, the vacuum of space, freezing temperatures, super salty environments. They can do it all. How do they do it? How do they survive the super cold of space, the frozen temperatures of their homes, these extremophiles? Well, it seems that rather than using an antifreeze protein in their cells like the snow fleas do, what they actually do is just tolerate ice formation in their body water. Not, to be clear, within the cells themselves, but in the interstitial fluid. So outside of their cells, ice forms, which seems totally, I mean, it's just another mind-boggling fact about the tardigrade, but they can basically go into this like shrunken down, they like curl up into a little pod and the inside of their body freezes and turns into ice and they're okay.
Tardigrades, again, surprising us all.
It's true. It's what they do. They just surprise us.
At this point, I'm not surprised, just because it's what I expect from them now.
Yeah, fair point. Yeah, maybe it would be surprising if this kills tardigrades. You'd be like, what?
Yeah. It's sort of like after a certain number of years of showing up to the Grammys wearing meat, Lady Gaga just stops being in the news for the crazy things she wears.
So we learned about a lot of really amazing physiological adaptations this episode. You guys taught me some things that I did not know. I didn't know sap was a adaptation of the cold. So that's pretty cool. And maple syrup. I learned something new. So we learned about blubber, some physiological adaptations to being homothermic or heterothermic. But I want to talk about some things that you might do in the cold that isn't physiological. So some things when you're dealing with these cold and difficult to live in environments where there's maybe less food, less sunlight, it's cold, you just want to go to bed, have a hot chocolate. So some things, and these are things that we've brought up in other episodes, but I thought it might be good to just kind of mention them here again because they're relevant to this episode as well. So one is hibernation. So several different animals hibernate. There was some debate for a while whether bears hibernate, but they've since changed the definition so it includes bears because there was some classification about how it had to be a really deep sleep for a certain amount of time, but for all intents and purposes, that is what bears do. So this involves sleeping for a long time. You're really slowing down your metabolic rate. You're taking advantage when there's lots of food and you're storing them in fat or different things, or maybe a cache. Some other animals do this as well. They have food stores where they'll take lots of food when it's plentiful and then consume it when it's not. Go to sleep in a burrow or a den and not be very active. So some things that do that are bears. Lots of different rodents do this as well. Another tactic is to leave where it's cold, so to migrate. So we talked about some animals, some really cool different cases of migration before. So we talked about the Arctic tern. That goes from the Arctic to the Antarctic, so it basically has summer all the time. We've also talked about some smaller cases of migration. This will annoy Nick, but the grouse, that only goes about a couple of hundred meters.
My favorite.
It's absolutely not a migration.
So say geese, we talked about those coming into the UK from colder areas. Other things, so it doesn't necessarily have to be moving in latitude. It could also be moving in altitude. So say things like elk or deer might move from kind of mountainy areas to further down into valleys to make use of other kind of sources of food and avoid heavy snowfall. So yeah, that's a little bit of a roundup of other adaptations to cold weather.
All these things out there, making it through. Think we can do it?
Yeah, I think we can manage.
I'm not dead yet.
True. My radiator's on 4. That's my adaptation.
Nice.
Same.
Naomi's under a blanket. So I think it's about time that we used our adaptations to maybe find a nice armchair next to a radiator, a nice cup of tea and some hearty soup. But we'll be back next week to talk all about caves. But until then...
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
In a way, tardigrades are a lot like Lady Gaga. Lady Tardigrade.